It is Friday, December the 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, Kosovo's prime minister says the new army will serve world peace, but there are concerns.
NATO is concerned of having another conflict, of course, and that's one of the big problems. They already have, of course, troops stationed there.
Trump investigations are mounting.
One of the difficulties that President Trump has right now is that the Russia investigation has continued to move forward, and it gets broader and broader, and the net gets broader and broader.
Also ahead, a new Mary Poppins movie, plus lots from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Kosovo's parliament today votes on whether to create a standing army out of the country's national security force, numbering about 5,000, with another 3,000 reservists. It's a move Serbia's prime minister warned could trigger military intervention in its breakaway province that declared independence in 2008. Belgrade, which has refused to recognize Kosovo as a country, has been able to keep from joining international organizations like the UN and last month the global police agency Interpol. That prompted Kosovo to level 100% tariffs on all Serbian imports in retaliation. Kosovo says the army would be used for handling crisis monitoring and response and civil protection operations and denied Serbian claims it would be used against the Serb-dominated north. NATO's Secretary General said the vote to create an army is ill-timed. He called for calm and restraint. Benoy Kammark is a senior lecturer in global studies at RMIT University in Australia, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty the historic animosity between the Serbs and Albanians go way back.
It goes back to an ancient disagreement between the Kosovo Albanians in the region of Kosovo, in the area there, of course, which is not officially recognized as a separate state by the Serbian government. And it also goes to the fact that Serbia regards a lot of Kosovo essentially as its ancient land, as it were. Certainly, it was where the famous Battle of Kosovo-Polje was fought in 1389. To stem the Turkish advance of that period. It is also where there are some of their sacred sites and monasteries. In Mitrovica, for example, it's a very notable area. This particular contest, of course, goes back to the time of the 1999 ethnic cleansing that took place as well and the NATO intervention. So there's a lot of bad blood between the sides, and so any suggestion of a beefed-up military force or formalized military force on the part of the Kosovo entity is going to be frowned upon by Serbia.
This was attempted last year, but the effort was squelched after international pressure. NATO and the U.S. have asked that the transformation be made with constitutional amendments that would need the ethnic Serb minority in order to pass. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg warning Kosovo that such a move is ill-timed, goes against the advice of NATO allies. What is NATO's concern?
Well, NATO is concerned of having another conflict, of course, and that's one of the big problems. They already have, of course, troops stationed there, some of their 4,600, including U.S. forces, and so they don't want to be in a situation where there's another open military confrontation between Serbian military units, for example, and of course, the Kosovo forces themselves. It would be a nightmarish remake, as it were, of what happened in the 1990s. So, at best, what they're trying to do, of course, is to create the circumstances where if there was to be such a force, it's representative of both ethnic Albanian groups and also the Serb groups in the region. But that's exactly one of the problems. There is a big disagreement as to how that force would be set up. And at this point, it's predominantly going to be ethnic Albanian, which is one of the big problems with the endeavor.
Why would Serbia threaten military intervention? This is such a modest force.
A lot of this is the old story of symbolism. The area of Kosovo is treated in all disproportion to its significance strategically. It is, to put it quite simply, the spiritual home, deemed the spiritual home by many of the monasteries associated with the Serbian faith of considerable fame and historical relevance in the region. And so these tend to be very significant points of pilgrimage every year. The point about an intervention would be prompted not so much with any power play so much as to see whether local Serbs there would be protected or not. So this is something that, of course, should be avoided because once it escalates, it will be very hard to contain.
Benoy Kammark is a senior lecturer in global studies at RMIT University. That's in Australia. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. We know that certain colors can influence how a food product should taste. Like when we're about to drink a yellow-colored beverage, many of us probably think we're about to taste something tart like lemonade. Penn State University researchers Molly Higgins and John Hayes wanted to find out how people learn to associate colors with tastes and whether they could be taught to link colors with completely different tastes. Over four sessions, the researchers got subjects to sip liquids with new colors they had specifically selected, avoiding any preconceived color taste pairings. Then the subjects were given uncolored liquids and were asked to pair each flavor with the new colors. It turns out the subjects picked the correct color taste match 59% of the time. The research will be published in the journal Food Quality and Preference. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. With a growing number of investigations against President Trump and his associates, the guilty pleas from his former national security advisor, his former campaign chair, and former personal attorney, there seems to be a sense Mr. Trump might not be able to escape unscathed. VOA's Lori London talks about all of this with criminal defense attorney Jack Rice.
You know, one of the difficulties that President Trump has right now is that the Russia investigation has continued to move forward, and it gets broader and broader, and the net gets broader and broader, because the more information that you have, the more it connects various different kinds of dots. And so more people get pulled into that net as you go, and the more of an investigation that you have, the more relevant information that you can acquire. And you also have a long history of other information that you already have in your possession. So when you look at where we are right now, we look at Michael Flynn. The fact that he has been cooperating is a huge deal. And by the way, suggesting that he should do no time says the kind of information that General Flynn has been giving to the Mueller investigation says that it has value. Just because he has something, if he can't help, sometimes you get nothing for it. Now, if you think about Cohen, Cohen, too, the recommendation in this case was 3 years. The 3 years that he's going to do, you still are seeing cooperation when it comes to that issue. The real story that's out there right now is the cooperation of the publisher from the National Enquirer. The reason that's particularly important is because when Cohen actually met with the publisher of the National Enquirer, and this was the crime in which he pled guilty, the president was in the room. The president doesn't have to say anything because Cohen actually works for him, which means the president was aware of a crime being committed. He was aware of the activity itself. And that in itself is enough to pull the trigger for an indictment. And the question is how this will work while a sitting president actually does what he does and how the Justice Department does what he does. The real issue here, though, is that you're actually seeing information coming from two sides of the same incident, and the only person who isn't in agreement, at least at this point, is the president himself. They both say, yeah, a crime was being committed. We knew it. We were both there. Oh, and the third guy, yeah, he's in the Oval Office. If there is a time to sweat, this is it.
So is it possible that the Russia investigation won't be the actual thing that does the most harm to this president or causes him the most legal problems?
Well, let's take a look at Bill Clinton. It started out with Whitewater, which was a real estate investigation. And it turned out that it was actually about him lying under oath and a blue dress. It's strange how that works, but one of the things that happens in federal investigations and one of the easiest things to prosecute is obstruction. One of the second easiest things to prosecute is lying to the FBI. So when you start looking at that, sometimes it's not shocking that you go for the low-hanging fruit. In this case, it's the easy prosecution because you have more and more information. And, of course, the president just answered a whole bunch of questions. And when he answers questions and the Mueller investigation knows a whole lot more about what's going on than probably the president does, you really potentially open yourself up to something particularly interesting.
The president did an interview with Fox News on Thursday, and he said that, you know, he didn't even think there was any payment to the National Enquirer for any of this, so therefore it was really nothing. And he also downplayed his relationship with Michael Cohen and Michael Cohen's position.
I think it's very clear at this point that there was a long-standing relationship with Michael Cohen and Donald Trump that goes long before he decided to run for the presidency, and there is lots and lots and lots of documentation that establishes that. This argument that he didn't know anything about the money being involved, the problem is when you're getting cooperation from all sides except him, every time he makes a statement. And if he's prepared to sit down and tell the FBI that, and you're going to get contradiction from those other two sources, that in itself is a crime. That in itself can put you in jail. And in fact, if you look at somebody like a Papadopoulos, he was the man who actually pled guilty earlier. One of the reasons he pled guilty was because he lied to the FBI. It wasn't even about content. It was about honesty. And that in itself is a crime. And that's something the president potentially faces. So this may work well and good for Fox News. This may work well and good for Twitter. But that doesn't particularly play when you're talking with the Department of Justice.
The president also said that, you know, they're just these prosecutors are just basically have it out for him, and they're just looking for something to get him on. Is that what prosecutors do?
In a case like this, they're going to prosecute based upon crimes committed. And if what the president describes as just trying to get me, if that's euphemistically describing a crime, then they are out to get him, because they're out to get him for the crimes that he might commit or may have allegedly committed. These are professionals, and these professionals were in place long before this man was president. Likely, they were in place long before the last Democrat was president, and the Republican before that. You see, that's what happens in this world, the intelligence world and the criminal justice world at this level, is that these people are pros. And so they don't look at this particularly like a left versus right. Sometimes they're cynical towards all of them because they see the cynicism that comes from politicians themselves. They're pros. Their job is to be professional because that's what they do. Mm. And I think that's what you're probably going to see here.
Just to sum this all up, how much trouble overall do you think this president is in, and can he survive all of this through an entire first term?
Here is the shift that seems to be taking place right now. What we are seeing is people who were standing by the president previously are starting to flip, and they're starting to cooperate with the Russian investigation. And that has to be disconcerting to this president, because you can't hide from that. In addition to that, what you are also seeing here is, I think, a political flip, even within the party themselves, where Republicans are starting to look at what's going on with this White House. And they're starting to assess whether or not he's helpful to them. Now, it sounds crazy that that's going to be an issue that matters in a criminal investigation, but it does. Because in this case, if you're talking about impeachment, and that's one of the questions that's out there, that is a political question, not a criminal question. And a willingness in the past to not look at it, to ignore it, is something that I think you're starting to see a shift on right now, and a willingness to actually say, well, let's talk about it, and pull on the Republican side of the aisle, not being afraid of this president.
That is Jack Rice. He is a criminal defense attorney. He was speaking with VOA's Lori London. A new edition of the Mary Poppins story, Mary Poppins Returns, opens in theaters. All of this just in time for the holidays. And as VOA's David Byrd tells us, at the film's London premiere, many of the stars, including lead actress Emily Blunt, said, what the world needs right now is a little Mary Poppins magic.
I was flying the kite and I got calls on a nanny.
Mary
Poppins, you came back.
You seem hardly to have aged at all.
Really? One never discusses a woman's age, Michael. Would have hoped I taught you better.
Emily Blunt takes on the role of the strict but kind nanny Mary Poppins in Mary Poppins Returns. Blunt takes over the role, which earned Julie Andrews an Oscar more than 50 years ago. In the new film from Disney, Mary Poppins is visiting the now-grown Michael and Jane Banks in a particular time of need. The new film is set in Depression-era London, 20 years after Mary's original appearance. This time, Michael Banks and his three children have suffered a tragedy, the loss of their wife and mother. At the London premiere, Emily Blunt said she thinks that Mary Poppins has a particular role in our world.
Bring order to chaos, I don't know. I think probably rather a lot. I think that's why she has a lot of relevance for people around the world when things feel rather fragile. I think that she's a great unifier, you know.
Blunt's co-star, award-winning writer and actor Lin-Manuel Miranda, said that Mary Poppins brings something the world needs, hope.
Boy, Mary Poppins, like, not a moment too soon, am I right? I mean, Mary Poppins doesn't come along when everything's okay. Mary Poppins comes along when there's trouble, and I feel like the world is in a scary time, and so it feels like a movie the world needs right now.
Emily Mortimer plays the grown-up Jane Banks. She says it was ironic that the premiere took place at a time of crisis in the British government over Brexit.
I think we'd all need a dose of Mary Poppins. I think that she's a mind bender. That's her particular art. She helps people see things from a new perspective. And I think that both in America and in Britain, we all need help seeing things in a new perspective, and hopefully that will bring some unity.
Writer-director Rob Marshall says he knew that Emily Blunt was the right person for the role from the very beginning.
Honestly, she was the first and only person I thought of for the role. And I think it's because we had just finished working with her on Into the Woods, and it was very clear to us that the huge demands of this role, she filled every single one of them. With her humor, with her singing voice, with her great acting ability, the layers that she plays as an actress.
Blunt, who has been nominated for 2 Screen Actors Guild Awards, one of them for Mary Poppins, says she hopes that years from now, audiences will be singing the songs from her film, just as they do from the original.
Well, I hope that generations to come will sing these songs. I think they're gorgeous. I think they're catchy and wonderful and will have the same imprint on people, you know.
Mary Poppins Returns also stars Ben Whishaw as Michael Banks, Oscar winners Meryl Streep as Mary's cousin Topsy and Colin Firth as Wilkins, and Dick Van Dyke, whom fans remember as Chimney Sweep Bert and Mr. Dawes Sr. in the original, makes an appearance as Mr. Dawes Jr. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
It has been written that Stevie Nicks makes rock music so nice they inducted her twice. Well, the Fleetwood Mac singer has made history as the first woman to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 2 times. Nick was inducted with Fleetwood Mac back in 1998, but Nick's solo work has earned her a spot in the 2019 Hall of Fame. Now a bit more of Stevie Nicks singing Gypsy. There is more from the world of music just around the corner. Hope you'll stay tuned. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Up next, what's behind Russia's most recent provocation of Ukraine? We'll talk with Will Pomerantz, deputy director of the Cannon Institute at the Wilson Center, and Mark Simakovsky, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, about why Russia attacked Ukrainian ships in the Kerch Strait in late November and the implications of this brazen assault. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat and dumbolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09.05 and 20.05 UTC, right after the international news.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now a bit more from the world of music. Barbara Harris, Barbara Parrott, and June Montero attended high school in the U.S. city of Jamaica, New York. They decided to form a singing group and got together after school to sing on street corners and in talent shows. After graduation, they were discovered at one of those talent shows and were signed to a record label, and the rest is history. They called themselves The Toys. Had a lot of quick hits. I Got a Man was one of them. So was Hallelujah. Quick popularity was evidenced by their record sales and spots on the R&B and pop charts. And like lots of musical groups, The Toys covered a song that had off-the-charts popularity in the 1960s, The Beatles' Yesterday.
Yesterday. Ooh, yesterday.
toys also went a little classical with an adaptation of Johann Sebastian Bach's Minuet in G titled A Lover's Concerto. Concerto scored number 4 on the R&B chart and number 2 on the pop chart, selling more than a million copies in 1965. Sadly, it was all over by 1968. The girls had differences and went their separate ways. Some say their popularity came on too quickly and overwhelmed Barbara Harris, Barbara Parrott, and June Montero. Harris reformed the toys in the 1990s for oldies reunion gigs, and Parrott and Montero still perform today as a duo. Concerto was a super hit in my youth back when I was about 15 years old, give or take a year. Hey, listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay with us for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from The Toys.
Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Earth and Sky.
This is Jorge Salazar. NASA scientists have taken close-up images from space of what they're calling spiders on the planet Mars. These spiders aren't life forms, but spidery-looking channels carved in ice at the South Pole of Mars. That's according to Candace Hansen of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who used images taken from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to understand how these Martian spiders came to be.
This is a very interesting process because there's nothing like it on planet Earth. What you have is, over the winter, a layer of translucent ice forms. It's carbon dioxide, so on Earth we would call that dry ice.
That's the same dry ice you sometimes see at Halloween.
In the spring, sunlight penetrates through the translucent ice and it warms the surface below the ice. So it's maybe a half a meter of CO2 ice that the sun has to go through. It warms the surface below, and then, as people familiar with dry ice on Halloween know, that ice will turn to a gas when it gets warm.
Hansen said that the gas below the layer of Martian ice is under pressure, so the gas looks for a weak spot to escape, such as a vent or a crack. As the gas shoots out, it carries along dust from the surface with it, which carves channels in the Martian surface as it gets blown up and out onto the top of the translucent ice. We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is VOA News.